chapter 8 of Romans, people like very much. It's more positive than chapter 7. Some of the summary items that we talked about in chapter 7, and I hope these will show up for those of you who had to leave because of travel, and I hope you got home safely. So not everyone got home safely. Heard there were some accidents this weekend. We talked about Paul's return to his discussion of flesh and spirit. He talked about flesh and spirit in chapter 6. No, 7. Verse 6. And introduced it there. He then digressed into a couple of questions for which the response was meganoita. Now he returns back to that, describing what it means to live in the flesh, describing what it means to live in the spirit, though he is not so literal as to bore us to death. He gives some nice parallels, and then he simply assumes that the audience can figure out the parallel and the flip. And we ended up with a comment that sin is more than mere inadequacy or failure. It's a choice of being in opposition to God. Paul's understanding of sin in the year 58 is different than our understanding in the year 2009. It's different. And if we're going to understand Paul, we have to use his words and his understanding, not our own. Paul has a very simple perspective, which remains on the board from Friday. Sin is on one side, and all the things associated with that. God is on the other. One is either in opposition to God, or one is acknowledging God. Paul's not real complicated when it comes to that. And so having discussed this flesh and spirit issue, he now turns, as we briefly stated, to the Roman church. Who is he writing to? Various churches at Rome, right? Various churches, various groups. We'll find out who those people are when we get to chapter 16 at the end of April. This is our last March meeting of Romans. Oh, we have less than a month left. I know you're saddened. I can see it. The tears dripping down your cheeks. Has he really addressed them throughout his argument? Well, he does in chapter 7. I'm writing to those of you who know the law, brothers. He's kind of at various times touched upon them, but now he moves into a very direct reference and said, now you, the Roman church that he's writing in 58, you are not in the flesh, you're in the spirit. He's taken this concept of flesh and spirit, which you might tend to gather from my discussion and bringing that highlighted from Friday's lecture, that's relatively critical issues, at which point you come out of your weekend slumber and you pick up your pencil and you start to write down and take notes and say, oh yes, he did say that the final was less well performed by previous classes because they didn't think we were doing anything new. And they're at the end of the semester and they feel like they're just kind of going downhill and they can just slide into the final. And that's what they usually do. And they move from a B to a C and an A to a B, and people slide their grade down in the final because they don't write anything down. But he says, you're not in the flesh, you are in the spirit. And then he begins to describe them in a different fashion. He describes what it means to be in the spirit, which is fairly important. He says, as the spirit dwells in you. People ask me lots of times because they think I have some answers and some knowledge, which is really not accurate, but there's a lot of things I don't know. They ask me, well, what do you have to do to be a Christian? And they think you're supposed to give a list. Well, would Paul give a list?
No.
No, not very much. So it's very simple. Unless the Spirit of God dwells in you, you're not a Christian, as Paul would describe it. That's the definition. That's the basic definition. That's what sets one apart. In fact, there's this guy named Tony Campolo. Anybody ever heard the name Tony Campolo? He's pretty famous. He's got this whole social school at Eastern Seminary in Pennsylvania. He wrote a book one time. Actually, he wrote about 28 books. He doesn't even have to take a salary. He just gets the money off his books and continues to do what he wants to do. And so Tony Campolo said that, I regress a little bit. He studies sociology and religion and very in tune with different ways of thinking, which I may have referenced to at some point. But he says there's this thing called evolution in which scientists feel that humans have evolved to a certain status. And he makes a statement that Christians are the upper rung of evolution. Because at that point, the Spirit of God dwells in them and they have become everything that God wants to. So he takes this Christian evolutionary sense and stance. It's kind of interesting. Some of you, the Dune series, ever pick up the Dune series?
Yes.
Yeah, a couple of you, right? Do they have a group of people who are like humans, elite, and others who aren't? They have this essence of humanity left in them and the others are just basically animals, right? J.R.R. Tolkien. Anybody read J.R.R. Tolkien trilogy? Right? We have this one person, sometimes named Strider, sometimes Elisar, sometimes Aragorn. Don't be Aragorn, that might be the wrong word. Aragorn. Who amazingly has this bloodline of some essence of humanity in him, and the rest just don't have it. It's not an unusual concept that Tony Campolo's mentioning. Other people have talked about it before. But Paul says, you're not in the flesh, you're in the Spirit, if the Spirit dwells in you. It's that simple. You are or you're not. He is not complicated. Anyone who does not have the Spirit of Christ does not belong to Him. Pretty simple. People like chapter 8. It's really encouraging. The Roman church at this point in time would have to be encouraged. Having gone through all of chapter 7, having talked about flesh and spirit, and then he goes, now you guys, you're not in the flesh. You're in the Spirit if the Spirit of God dwells in you. So, what's that mean? Well, he doesn't explain it in a great sense of detail, but people have talked about it for 2,500 years or so after. A little exaggeration there on the 2,500 years, right? And if you're not, you don't belong. And he kind of makes some references back to chapter 6 where he's talking about slave to sin, slave to righteousness, okay? But then he turns around and said, if Christ is in you. Oh, come on, Paul, give us a break. How can the Spirit be in you and Christ be in you? Aren't they two separate things? Does Paul make any distinguish between God, Spirit, Christ? No. Why would people read through Romans back in the first century, in the second century, in the third century, reading in Greek because they actually read Greek and spoke Greek and they knew what Greek was saying, and think, oh man, Paul is describing this thing we're going to call Trinity. We're going to call it Trinity. And this is what he's describing. God, Jesus, Spirit, three different names, three different functions, but the same essence. And then there's a big debate because the Greek and the Latin, and you don't want to know that, that's a whole another issue. Problem when you start translating into languages. People just don't understand what's being said. But Paul says, the Spirit's in you, Christ is in you. Is there any distinction between the two in Paul's mind?
No.
No, there's not. He's done this quite a few times throughout. So if Christ is in you, though your body is dead, the Spirit is life because of righteousness. Body is dead. Body is dead? Where is he talking about the body being dead? Whose body was dead? Abraham's body was dead. All you got to do is have the notes in front of you. It's right there, right? Just trying to help people who don't have the notes. Okay? You have life just like Abraham. And you have life just like whose other body was dead? Jesus. But are your bodies really dead? He's writing to the Roman church. Hey, you Romans, your bodies are dead. Well, if their bodies were dead, where would they be? In the catacombs. Buried. That's what you do with dead bodies. You bury them. When he says dead, does he mean scientific definition so we can sign a certificate and you can get the inheritance? Dead? It means the absence of life. There's no life. Not a strange concept if you read science fiction books. Even if you watch strange movies, there are dead people who have some absence of life, and yet they're not, bodies aren't dead. So we give them a name like the undead or zombies. Something fun. You got to watch those. You guys are up at 2 in the morning. Get off of Facebook and start watching TV. You'll learn something. Okay? You'll learn something. So what's he telling to the Romans? He says, here's an example of faith that justifies Abraham's faith. Y'all are like Abraham. What's he mean? You have the faith that justifies. Whoa, that's pretty good stuff. Do people like Romans chapter 8? You bet. So, here's the problem. A guy named Martin Luther lived about 1480 to about 1550. Around 1511, 12, 13, 14, 15, he had studied, gone to school, gone to college. They had colleges back in the 1500s. Gone to college, he was a doctor of law, read the letters of Paul, was reading through the letters of Paul, studying the letters of Paul, reading through Romans. He thought, whoa, this is kind of important. So there's some questions I want to talk about. And October 31st, 1517, he put 95 questions on a door in Wittenberg, Germany, to have a discussion about. Nobody wanted to talk. They didn't like asking questions. See, there's the thing. If people don't want you to ask questions, you got to be careful. If they want you to ask questions, well, it's a whole other thing. But he wanted to have these public discussions about the issues. And you know what happened. He got kicked out. They were trying to kill him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Great historical story. There's a movie called Luther. It's not too bad to watch every once in a while. But then, because his premise was sola fide, justification by faith alone, is only faith that justifies, he started reading James, said, you know what, James says you got to have works, and that's just not right. And so if you pick up a Luther Bible today, you'll find James does not follow Peter. Of course, it doesn't follow Peter.
Wait a second.
Any Bible you pick up doesn't even follow Hebrews. Doesn't follow Hebrews, which is where it's supposed to be, Hebrews, James. But it goes Hebrews, Peter, Jude. Nope, John, Jude, Revelation.
You're on the ball today.
I'm doing great today, aren't I? Because Luther thought James was so antithetical to sola fide, he wanted to remove it from the canon. He removed a lot of things of the Old Testament. We call the Old Testament deuterocanonical writings because they weren't written in Hebrew. And Martin Luther provided the first translation into a modern language from the original Hebrew and Greek. He was not a stupid person. He knew his languages. So if you pick up a Luther Bible, which is I think where I started, you will find James after the book of Revelation because he didn't want to take it out of the canon. He just didn't want anybody to read it. And if you've read through Revelation, you know, once you've read that, you just stop because you're wiped. Actually, you get to about 12 or 13, you just go, this is strange, you just drop it, you don't read it. He didn't want people to read it. So, is James antithetical to Paul? That's the question.
What's antithetical? What's
antithetical is like the antithesis, the opposite of, on extremes.
What's
thesis. Antithetical is the adjective form of thesis.
Oh.
Right? So, Romans 7, for this reason the mind that is set on flesh is hostile to God, does not submit to God's law, indeed it cannot. If we bump over to James, and we look in chapter 4, fortunately I don't use a Luther Bible, it's still right there, right after Peter.
Which Peter?
He says, adulterers, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Enmity means enemies of God. Whoever wishes to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. And what's Paul say? The mindset of the flesh is hostile to God. Is James antithetical to Peter?
No.
No. If we go on, verse 9, you are not in the flesh, you are in the Spirit. The Spirit of God dwells in you. We go to James. Do you suppose it's for nothing that the Scripture says, God yearns jealously for the Spirit He has made to dwell in us? Does Paul say the Spirit dwells in us? Yes. Does James say the Spirit dwells in us? Yes. Are James and Paul antithetical?
No,
they're not. You have to understand the... Surely you can guess the word. Context. Of Luther. You have to understand Luther's context. And what was happening within Catholicism, which was the only choice in town, in the late 1400s and early 1500s. But that's another story. James is not antithetical to Paul. Yes, Martin Luther was not infallible. He was wrong. Most people agree with that. So, Paul is now going to describe for who? Who's his audience? The Christians in Rome. The church in Rome. Right? He's going to describe some things. If Christ is in you, though the body's dead, the Spirit is life because of righteousness. You're like Abraham. Okay? If the Spirit of Him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, very much a reference to the end of chapter 4. Right? Does Paul go back and go back and go back and go back and make references and say, you got to understand this to understand what I'm saying? Yes. That's this whole section is trying to explain and extract from his argument. The one who raised Christ from the dead will give life to your mortal bodies, who also brought his Spirit to the dwells with. So, we are debtors not to the flesh to live according to the flesh. We're not debtors. He's going to use later on, some of you will have the chance of doing this language, debtors. Talking to somebody that evidently at this point in time there's a lot of bankruptcies. A lot of people aren't paying their mortgages on their houses. And the person, being a financial wizard, said, you know what? We just ought to put them in debtor's prison. But, oh, we don't have that anymore. They used to throw people in prison who couldn't pay their debt. Wouldn't that be nice? We could get rid of a lot of people. Except the prisons they threw them in didn't have cable TV and internet access and air conditioning or any of those nice things. He says, we are not in debt to flesh. What's it mean to be in debt to somebody?
Oh.
You owe them something. You're obligated to them. He says, we're not obligated to the flesh. We don't have to live according to the flesh, right? Because if we live according to the flesh, you die. If the Spirit... you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. So he's starting to describe some things. Over here is what? Death. Here, if we put up here Spirit, we have life. Right? He says, okay, churches of Rome, here's what I'm saying. You know, I don't know what people are saying about me, but here's what I'm saying. You are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if this is the case. If this is the case, then all these things tend to come about. If you live in the Spirit, you'll put to death the deeds, because all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. So if the Spirit dwells in you, then also Christ is in you. So we can just go ahead and put that up here as well, because we're pretty much Trinitarian. He says, and if that's the case, then you are children. Technically, he says sons, but that's because writing in 58, they didn't have political correctness. Everyone understood this term in the plural to be encompassing male and female. Unfortunately, somewhere along the line, people forgot that there was this inclusiveness, and they want to be more specific and make us write sons or daughters or something else. You become children, but wait. In chapter 6, what did he say we were? See, I can't ask that on the final. I can ask it now, right?
Well, how does he describe it in chapter 6? Because that's chapter 6.
He describes us as slaves. He says we're slaves to sin, but because of redemption, we're now slaves to righteousness. So we can put that up here.
Seems to be an important word.
But no longer are we slaves. He says we're now children. Is there a difference between slaves and children? Yeah, there's a big difference between slaves and children. Which one has higher status?
Children.
Trick question.
Not by much.
Slaves. Why? Infancy mortality rates. Roman father could just as well have his child put to death as a slave put to death with no ramifications of the law. And in fact, the children were subject to the slave until they reached a certain age. He says, you're children. And when you reach a certain age, then something magical happens and you're now above slaves. Because you're not in the spirit of slavery, you're actually free. And there's the difference. But on the social ladder, slaves still were over the children, kind of fun thing. So we're not slaves, we're children. And he goes on to say, because you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall into fear. Did slaves live in fear in the first century? I would assume so, right? Because if slaves didn't live lives of fear in the first century, Paul would not say that slaves had a spirit of fear. Because people go, huh, what are you talking about? We don't have any fear. We have some evidence of what things were like. Yeah, why? Well, because if they did not obey the master, what happened? Could they be beaten? Greatly. To the point of death. Could they be killed? Yes. Any ramifications for the owner? No. Not under Roman law. The world in 58 was much different than it is today. Much, much different. We're not slaves. We're children. You received a spirit of adoption. Now, there's interesting. Are they children of God by birth? No. How are they children of God? By adoption. Did the Romans practice adoption? Oh, yes, all the time. In fact, you may know some people who were adopted. You know Julius Caesar? You've heard of Julius Caesar? He was succeeded by his son, Augustus Caesar, right? Julius Caesar was succeeded by Augustus Caesar, named Octavian, correct? Except that Octavian was the grandnephew of Julius Caesar, not his son. How did he become his son? By adoption. And Augustus was succeeded by his son Tiberius, except that Tiberius and Germanicus, his brother, were born to another person, And we're not even genetically linked to Augustus. So how did Tiberius become his son? Through adoption. Do the Romans know about adoption? Yes, it's practiced all the time in the ancient world. What's the thing about adoption? You can't unadopt. Now, children, you could actually sell into slavery. A parent could sell his born child into slavery. And in fact, they often did. Why? To pay off debts, Miss Hines. To pay money they owed. But you could not unadopt an adopted child. And so you received a spirit of adoption in which you cry, Abba, Father. Tenderness, Papa, Dad. Very close type of relationship. So, we are children, not slaves. And then he says, and if this is the case, then we are children of God. We are also heirs of God. Wow, that's pretty good. How many of you would like to be an heir to Bill Gates? Come on, get your hands up. You all know you would, right? How many of you have that rich uncle you're hoping will die soon and so you can get their money? You try and be their favorite. Nobody? When do you get to be an heir?
When someone dies.
When they die. Until they die, you're not an heir. But that's not how it is here, because in the Roman culture, Miss Claver, once someone took on the mantlehood of sonship, they were then an heir. And they had the same authority as the father to do business. They had possession of everything. And when they were declared the heir, as Julius Caesar declared Augustus the heir, and Augustus declared Tiberius the heir, and Tiberius declared Caligula, which was really strange, the heir, then you have this possession. But how does one become an heir of God? Well, just summarizing, right? So he's saying, you Roman church, you're different. You're no longer slaves. You've been adopted into this new identity. And when someone is adopted, they actually begin to take on the practices of that household, the prestige of that household. They even wore the jewelry of that household. Anybody read Princess Diaries? Not read it. Probably didn't read it. Anybody read the book, Princess Diaries? Anybody see the movie, Princess Diaries? Of course you saw the movie. Didn't read the book. Probably wasn't a book. What did her grandmother give her when she came to visit? A piece of jewelry, a locket that was her father's. And why was it special? What did this locket do? It opened up the diary so she could read her dad's diaries. Could anybody outside the family get that piece of jewelry? No. She was being brought into the family. People like Romans chapter 8. Because it's really kind of pretty exciting when you start getting to it. You're not a slave. You're a son. You have the spirit of the son. You're able to call the person Abba, Father. Daddy. Could a slave refer to them in that way? Not at all. But he says, if you are an heir, you are a joint heir with Christ. Now, we all know about limited resources. Dad dies, leaves the family $100,000. There's five kids. Each of them get how much?
$20,000.
Isn't that how it works? We take whatever there is, we split it up. That's one of the problems that these 160-acre land plots that the government gave the settlers, when they had eight kids, how many acres did each kid get? 20 acres. Could you live on 20 acres? No. So what did they do? They went and they kept the land in common. They all owned it. To be a joint heir means you don't divide the property. Because if you divide the property, it is partitioned off. To be a joint heir is to maintain it all. So if you're a joint heir with Jesus, well, Paul is saying, whatever Jesus inherits, you also inherit. I don't know about you, but people get excited about Romans chapter 8 because it's pretty good. So how do you prove that you are a, and I like the term, in case you're wondering, with heir, because Paul uses a prefix soon here that just amplifies the withness. It's not like you and Jesus over there, but it's like you're linked up and held in common with. Kind of interesting. How do you show that you're a with heir? Well, it says you have to with suffer. If, in fact, we suffer with him. How did Jesus suffer? He had to die. There's lots of other ways he suffered. We could go into those in ad nauseum if we wanted to, but we won't here. He had to die. So what do you have to die to be a with heir? You have to die. Your bodies have to become dead to sin. How do they become dead to sin? How do you die to sin? Oh, I'm certainly glad he wrote chapter 6. I'm glad that he's going back to reference something so we don't have to ask the question, how does one die to sin? He's already answered it back in chapter 6. Of course, you all know the answer because you took time to learn that information. But what happens if we are with heir with Christ and we with suffer with Christ? The result is we are with glorified with Christ. How has Christ been glorified? Well, there's lots of places in the New Testament to talk about that. Paul doesn't really go into detail right here. Why? Because he assumes they know. He assumes they know that he has been glorified. He has been exalted. He has been lifted up. He has been raised and seated at the right hand of God. And where will those who are with heirs and with suffer and are with glorified with Christ be? So that's, I don't know, people kind of get excited about chapter 8. Because Paul says we're not slaves anymore. We were slaves. And we're now slaves to righteousness. We have to do righteousness, but more than that, we're sons of God, which means we now take on the characteristic of the household of God. And the way we know that we are with heirs with Christ is we with suffer. I think we've talked about suffering before. I think we're going to talk about suffering again. We just don't want to talk about suffering today because most of you want to go eat lunch. So we're done.